Good afternoon, everyone. Meeting will come to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but in the interest of getting going and being respectful of those who are here on time, I thought we would get started, and we will officially convene the meeting once we have a few more people here and can have a quorum. Got a couple of items of business today. First of all, looking at an item from the November forecast, the state's payment of an IRS penalty, and then, of course, a review of the February forecast. And I do want to thank our committee legislative assistant, Shirley, for bringing cookies. You know, it's been months. I'm not sure how I survived all this time without them, but but anyway, it's good to be back. I guess I'll start out by recognizing Commissioner Franz. And Commissioner, we'll have you up there a couple times today, but I think you've got a presentation on this IRS situation.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to, I'm going to try to both speak from my notes and navigate the slideshow for you here as well. What I want to start off talking about is the purchase of state bonds by the State Board of Investment. This presentation will really be divided into two categories: a discussion of how the bond purchase occurred, the timing of the bond purchase, and also then the disclosure of that bond purchase and the payment thereafter. As this is just a little bit of background, but as most of you know, the State Board of Investment is the only entity allowed to invest state funds held in the state treasury on behalf of the state. Now, other state entities can use fiscal agents outside money managers, for example, the University of Minnesota. But the State Board of Investment is responsible for the formulation of state investment policies and for the purchase and sale of securities. Monies and various funds are invested according to regulations on types and terms of investments imposed by law in each type of grouping in the State Board of Investment. The investment groups include invested treasury cash, temporary investment. Those are temporary investments for a pool of cash that are not immediately needed, and funds that are from other funds dedicated by the state constitution, state law, or by federal law. We also have highway funds, where there are temporary investments of bond proceeds and receipts not immediately needed. We have various retirement funds, where there are investment of assets and reserves. We have trust funds, also where there's investment of assets and reserves, and there are other departmental funds. But what I want to take you to next is the IRS regulation. I don't think you can read the panels very easily, but hopefully your handout will show you. The IRS regulates state and local bonds, and one of the things the IRS does, it tells states when they can buy or sell and how and when a state can sell its own state bonds. The IRS issues guidance to help, at least they call it help. For example, there's a couple IRS notices that are listed on the sheet. But the first rule that I want to talk about today that's relevant is the IRS rule that says that a state must not buy state bonds, or it must not buy bonds issued by other state organizations. The IRS views the purchase of the state agency bond as a retirement or an extinguishment of the originally issued bonds. This causes compliance problems for the bonds, in particular if they are later resold, and under these circumstances the IRS can charge penalties. The second rule that I want to talk about is a rule that says the state cannot resell state bonds. So this can affect the tax-exempt status of all outstanding bonds issued by the state entities. And again, the IRS can charge penalties. The IRS views the secondary sale. So let's assume a state agency buys a state bond and then resells that bond. The IRS views that secondary sale as if it should be a taxable debt. And then in that situation, the IRS is losing out on the income that it would normally receive if it was not a tax-exempt bond. It would not be a tax-exempt bond in that circumstance. So after the initial sale of tax-exempt bonds go into the market, both the buying and the selling of bonds is against IRS regulations, and reselling them could actually subject the entire tax-exempt status of all bonds subject to taxation. The agencies that are prohibited from purchasing state bonds are listed on this next slide, and these are the state entities that are authorized to issue debt, They are prohibited from purchasing bonds by any one of these state agencies, and they're listed there. And in addition, there are several bond proceeds and city bonds that are prohibited from being bought by a state agency. So let's get to the matter at hand here, and that is the SBI purchase and resale of some state bonds. In 2010, SBI made 9 purchases of state general obligation bonds that totaled about $14.8 million. And in 2010, the SBI also made Minnesota Public Facilities Authority bond, purchase a bond totaling $7.5 million. In 2011, there was one purchase of a state GO bond totaling $1 million. And during 2011 through 2014, all of the purchased state GO bonds were ultimately sold. So what happened? So after the SBI had purchased these bonds and then later resold them, it was in September of 2012 that MMB discovered this issue in its normal review of state bond issues. At that point, MMB notified bond counsel, and MMB began researching all the investment transactions related to GO bonds between September 2012 and January 2013. MMB bond counsel reported all inappropriate GO bond transactions to the IRS. The IRS has a self-reporting program in which any entity that is violating the rules can self-report to the IRS and negotiate a penalty if there is one that's due. So at the same time, in March of 2013, MMB directed the State Board of Investment to refrain from purchasing any state bonds in compliance with the previously discussed IRS regulations. It was in September of 2014, the next year, that the IRS and MMB finalized a settlement. At that time, MMB made a payment of $537,000 and $25 penalty payment. Now, the SBI does not have authority to make such a payment, so MMB made the payment out of the general fund, and I'll get to that statutory authority in just a moment. So in September of 2014, the payment of the IRS penalty was made by MMB, and in the November forecast in 2014, as referenced by the chair, the IRS penalty payment was reflected as spending in the fiscal 15 budget documents. Now, what happened when we learned there's another issue in terms of the purchase of state bond, and that was with the Public Facilities Authority. In February 2014, MMB discovered that the SBI had purchased a bond on behalf of the Public Facilities Authority, and we also notified bond counsel again at that time. So between April and May of 2014, MMB directed the SBI, PFA, Public Facilities Authority, and the Minnesota Housing Finance Authority to refrain from selling that particular PFA bond. So in September of 2014, the IRS and the PFA reached a settlement in which the PFA made a payment for some previously purchased. It was at this time that we discovered that there was a 2008 purchase of a bond, PFA bond, that was sold in 2012, and then the IRS required that there be a penalty paid on that of $42,660. That was paid in September of 2014. In January of 2016, in the annual report of PFA, that penalty payment was reflected. It was paid out of PFA funds and not out of the general fund. So let me talk a little bit about the statutory authority for MMB to make this IRS payment in 2014. It's Minnesota Statute Section 16A.641, Subdivision 6. It's on the frame there, but if anyone can read that, I'll be surprised. What this statute requires is that MMB, the statute grants MMB the authority to pay a penalty, which we call the cost of compliance, to the federal taxing authority, in this case the IRS, and appropriates the funds to MMB to enable it to make the payment. So this gives the statutory power of MMB to make this payment, and SBI does not have similar authority. I just want to note at this time that the last time that MMB used this particular authority to make an IRS penalty was in 2003 for a $53,000 tax arbitrage payment at that time. So what we've been able to put together since that time are two different ways to deal with this issue of the purchase of state bonds by the SBI or any state agency. So we've issued two new policies. We have a new statewide...
Commissioner, let me just go back to 16A.641. So what is the language in there that gives the administration the authority to write a check for $537,000 to the IRS?
What is the language?
Yeah.
Sure. If you go to the last sentence, a sum sufficient to meet the cost of compliance is annually appropriated to the commissioner from the general fund.
Okay. So you're viewing that as just basically a blanket appropriation to pay for any sort of fines like this?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Okay. Go ahead. Well, actually, as long as I've interrupted you, why don't I go ahead and officially convene the meeting, because we do have a quorum. We do have a quorum. The meeting is officially convened, and actually we've got some minutes from some prior meetings, May 16th, June 5th, and June 11th, that are in your packets that were never approved. Does anyone have any questions on those? Representative Carlson moves approval.
That was what I was going to do, no question, just to move approval.
All right, thank you. Representative Druskowski.
I've just got a question for you.
You have a question on the minutes?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. Seeing no other questions or discussion on the minutes, all in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. All right. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Good new to you.
I haven't seen you since, so thank you for your presentation. Just following up on the chair's question, can you provide a little more clarity around that? So is there an actual number that appears in our budget documents each year that shows an appropriation as we comply with this particular section, that sentence that you pointed out?
Mr. Commissioner. Chair, Representative, no, there's no. It's an open, ongoing appropriation.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
So if you take a look at this next slide, what we've tried to do, and right now I'm talking specifically about the problem of the purchase of state bonds by SBI, so or any particular state agency. So we've issued two new procedures here to try to handle that. The first one is what we call Minnesota MMB Statewide Operating Policy 1040-01, which prohibits the purchase of state bonds by state entities. The policy objective here is to clarify and communicate to all agencies that either issue bonds or can buy bonds to avoid non-compliance with the IRS guidance and penalties. We want to make sure that the state agencies have the ability to invest funds, but they do not do so through any trustee that inadvertently would purchase a state bond. We've sent this policy to the affected state agencies, and we've communicated this to all agency heads. But in addition to issuing that policy, the next slide shows that we've taken steps to prevent it by requiring an annual certification. We have an annual certification form 0104-01 that requires all agencies to annually certify compliance with this policy 1040-01. So in addition to the policy, we wanted to make sure that all agencies annually take the affirmative step of certifying to MMB that they are in compliance with the policy. And I can report that all agencies that we've sent this form to have complied already this year for the 2015 survey and certification. We'll be doing this on an annual basis to make sure we get this annual certification by all agencies.
Commissioner, can I interrupt you and recognize Representative Albright?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Franz, you mentioned that this or a similar situation occurred in 2003, and there was remediation, a payment was made to the IRS. I'm just curious, as we talk about policies and procedures that were implemented because of the occurrence that we're dealing with today, I'm curious as to what policies and procedures were implemented then when that occurred in 2003 and how they might be different from the ones that you're implementing today.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, as best I recall from what I've learned about previous occasions is there used to be a fairly routine, not routine, but fairly common practice of making tax arbitrage payments in the late 1990s and in early 2000s. And so those payments were routinely reported. But what's happened is we have not had those kind of payments for over almost 12 years now. And so I'm not sure what policies they had in place at that time to report them. I'm simply indicating that we haven't had one of those similar occasions since 2003.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Franz, and Mr. Marks kind of pointed out to me how the arbitrage stuff worked. And as I'm looking at the language here, it says, so sufficient to meet the cost of compliance, realizing that this statute is a fragment of that arbitrage era, if you will. And that was for a time when we were actually required to pay the federal government because of some interest earned that wasn't anticipated or wasn't calculated or whatever. But this is actually a penalty, which is different than interest earned. Can you comment on does this statute specifically, does it include penalties? Do you just read it broadly that it includes any time the IRS wants money, it's they can have it, and you can pay it, or any comment you can give us on that would be helpful.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our interpretation of Section 641, I'll call it, Subdivision 6, puts certain responsibilities onto the Minnesota Management and Budget Commissioner to certify the, to make sure that the bonds that have been approved meet all the necessary conditions, but it also requires that the commissioner make sure that the holders of the bonds comply with all the provisions of the IRS code or any later enactments to that. So it's our belief that that requirement that the commissioner must comply with the Internal Revenue Code and also then must be able to make sure that we refrain or act in compliance with those covenants of, under the IRS code provides the authority to pay the sum sufficient for the total cost of compliance with respect to those IRS code or regulatory requirements.
So, Commissioner, if we were doing this before and it was permissible to make money off this arbitrage as long as we paid some sort of a tax on our gains, did the law change in the meantime to say that this is now illegal?
I think it was
because that's why we apparently got a penalty, right? We did something that was illegal?
Mr. Chair, what we did this particular time was very different than the arbitrage payments that were made back in the early 2000s. This was the violation of the provision against purchasing state bonds by a state agency. So this is strictly a penalty. Did not have anything to do with earning any interest. What was happening in this particular case is that the purchase of a state bond by a state agency and the resale of that bond is depriving the IRS of interest that would have been paid on that taxable bond under that circumstance. So the penalty is based upon the interest that the IRS would have gotten had that been declared a non-tax exempt bond.
Right, but I guess my question is, this is an actual penalty for an illegal transaction. It's not a case where we didn't pay income tax on some earnings on which we should have paid tax.
Mr. Chair, correct.
Okay. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Franz, for being with us today. So if I'm just trying to follow 641 here. This is the language that actually tells you to stay in compliance with the IRS. Is that correct?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
And so you're using that same language to authorize payments of a penalty.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
It seems like rather a circular argument in a way.
Boxes and chicken coops.
Kind of unusual. And it's not... doesn't clearly spell out here that this is for the purpose that this language is here to authorize payments of penalties. If I might, another question,
yep.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Who is on the State Board of Investment, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the four constitutional officers are on the State Board of Investment.
And
Representative Perkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's, you know, that's the question that I've been wrestling with since this was first discovered, discovered by our nonpartisan staff, not reported directly in any highlighted manner by you, but really was a single line on a report that staff luckily noticed and caught up on, and we thank them for that. The timing of this just seems very unusual, that it took so long for this to be reported. And when it was reported, it wasn't really reported, it was just included on a spreadsheet. And can you defend this process?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I'd like to do, first of all, is describe the process and explain from my point of view what happened and explain, in my view, sort of why there was a problem with the reporting. So as you'll recall, in between 2012 and 2014, the MMB was working on discovering, negotiating with the IRS, and then making a payment with the IRS in September of 2014. And that payment made in September of 2014 did not actually show up in the expenditure documents until the forecast, 2015 forecast, in December, as you said. So I think one of the keys that a couple things happened along the way, and I'll back up a little bit and talk a little bit about the CAFR, because the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report also is relevant to the time frame in terms of what happened and when this was reported. For those of you who are familiar with the CAFR, you'll know that it's the financial statement for the estate. It includes disclosures necessary to accurately present the financial condition of the state for the previous year. It's prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. It includes an audit opinion from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and it's due by December 31st of each year. So what happened in this particular year, the August through December, MMB submits the CAFR components to the Office of OLA for their independent audit, and MMB included the IRS payment as an expenditure, but it did not include a separate disclosure in the documents to the OLA because MMB determined the amount was immaterial based on industry practice and advice from bond counsel. In December 18th, the OLA issued an unqualified audit opinion regarding the CAFR that was to be released on December 31. Well, it was about that time in later December that this the IRS penalty payment became public information, and the OLA at that time retracted their audit opinion on the 21st of December. On December 22nd, in meeting with the OLA, MMB decided to add a note in the CAFR that disclosed information about the IRS penalty payment. And then on February 11th, the OLA audit was issued regarding this and found that MMB should have discussed the issue with them. But I think it's important to talk about the finding that the OLA made in their review of the reporting of this issue in the CAFR. The Department of Management Budget did not have adequate internal controls to ensure it informed us about a settlement with the Internal Revenue Service and discussed with us whether it warranted disclosure in the notes to the financial statements. After discussions with the OLA, there was an agreement that it was properly not included in the CAFR in terms of a note, but it was something the OLA recommended. In fact, the OLA recommendation was that MMB should strengthen internal controls to ensure that it informs us about uncommon transactions and discuss potential disclosures for those transactions in the notes to the financial statements. So what has happened since then is we have issued a new policy, and I'll get back to your original question. I'm not forgetting your original question, Representative. So what we've done is we've issued three new procedures. We've issued a new internal MMB policy. We've issued a new internal MMB procedure to the budget forecast process. And we have new information on our annual internal control self-assessment tool. So as I walk through this, I guess I would like to start off by saying I'm disappointed that this transaction was not reported at the time of the settlement or payment. We are committed at MMB to being transparent and accountable in communicating our liabilities and financial information. And we've implemented procedures to ensure that compliance information is reported timely in the future. This first new policy would help accomplish that by requiring if the MMB must make a payment under Section 641, as part of a process for noncompliance, our new policy requires that any such payments to the IRS be reported to the legislature and the Office of Legislative Auditor at the time of payment. This would, of course, include House Ways and Means Committee, Senate Finance Committee, the House Capital Investment Committee, the Senate Capital Investment Committee, and the Office of Legislative Auditor. The second point we've done is to change our November and February forecast process improvements. Prior to this February, our process for determining forecast expenditure data for the current fiscal year relied on agencies to communicate exceptions to fiscal year closing data.
Excuse me, I'm going to recognize Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner France, in the new policy that you put forth, though, which didn't happen until February 8th of 2016, that's 4 years after the problem was recognized and then reported to the IRS. So you didn't put a new policy in place until 4 years after the infraction actually happened. And my question to you is, in the language that you've put forth in your new policy that you want to have, you only say it allows for payment to the IRS, that that's when the legislature is notified. Well, it took you 2 years to reach a settlement with the IRS, so are we going to be left in the dark for 2 years or however long it takes for you to determine what the policy is going to be or what the payment's going to be to the IRS? I mean, we should have been notified back in 2012. And this is 4 years later, and it was tucked away.
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, there's no payment or settlement to report until there actually is an agreement with the Internal Revenue Service. The negotiation process is lengthy. It takes time. But to the extent there is an agreement reached, it's only then that we can report the result of that agreement. If the IRS had determined there was no penalty due, there would have been no need to make the report. And we simply can't project until we actually reach an agreement with the Internal Revenue Service whether there's going to be an agreement or a payment to be notified about.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Commissioner France, I have a real concern that we are doing things that we're not supposed to be doing, and then the legislature's left out of the dark, allowed in the dark. This happened in 2012. It's been 4 years, and the legislature was never told about this. I don't care if there's a penalty charged by the IRS. We still should have been told back in 2012. If nothing else, to give us an opportunity to look at what do we need to plan for, or what policies does the legislature, not the agency that can be changed at anybody else's will, but the legislature setting the policies of how we're going to handle situations like this. I think I'm really concerned about the lack of transparency on this completely.
So, Commissioner, so just so we understand the new policy, what you're saying is the new policy would notify Ways and Means, Capital Investment, Senate Finance, the Office of Legislative Auditor, about a situation like this after the penalty had been agreed upon with the IRS and not before. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. One of the difficulties in any negotiation with the IRS or any other federal agency, as far as that goes, is the difficulty and the uncertainty regarding negotiations. I was a tax lawyer for 30 years and settled many, many, many cases, and you're never sure of any settlement until you actually sign the dotted line. And so the extent to which it makes it difficult to communicate with the Internal Revenue Service or any other federal agency, if you're providing documents outside of that negotiation to outside parties, it's the nature of reaching an agreement requires that there be confidential negotiations until there's a settlement or an agreement reached.
Well, Commissioner, but I mean, realizing that the way the IRS first learned about this, as I understand, was the state self-reporting, which is appropriate, and I'm glad the state did that, but why wouldn't it be appropriate for the state to also, the executive branch, self-report to the legislative branch that there's an issue here without knowing, of course, what the eventual settlement or cost might be? Why wouldn't it be appropriate for you to just notify the legislature that there's an issue and we've notified the IRS about it?
Mr. Chair, there are particular provisions or circumstances where that may be appropriate, but I think it's difficult in the abstract to simply say, as a matter of practice, that that can always be done. There are certain situations that require confidentiality, and so until we can predict with some degree of certainty what those occasions might or might not be, in my view, the determination of reaching an agreement with the IRS is that appropriate time that the legislature should be informed about it.
Can you give an example of a circumstance in which you would think it would not be appropriate to notify the legislature, but it would be appropriate to notify the IRS?
Mr. Chair, well, if in fact the IRS requires, in some cases they do, confidentiality of the documents that they're exchanging between with and between MMB. So there are some times that the IRS requires its negotiations to be confidential and require that you not disclose any information in the process of that determination. So the IRS can require that in certain circumstances.
Well, I'd be curious to really see the details of that requirement, because, I mean, you know, the legislature is the state of Minnesota, too, not just the office of MMB. And it seems strange to me that the IRS would say that the executive branch is the only one that can know the details of something like this.
Mr. Chair, we're not saying the legislature should not know about it. We're simply saying there are certain points in time which make it difficult to disclose that prior to having certain knowledge about reaching an agreement about what the conduct may or may not be or what the penalty may or may not be. So clearly the legislature should be informed, and that's the nature of this policy, is to make sure the legislature is informed.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Franz, did the IRS at any point tell you that this negotiation that you had with them, that needed to be kept secret from the legislature?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I was informed that certain of the documents exchanged with the IRS had a non-disclosure requirement attached to some of them. I don't know all of them or to what extent. I know that some of the documents had a non-disclosure requirement attached to them. I don't know the facts of those.
Commissioner.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, so Commissioner Franz, at no time did the IRS tell you that you could not tell the legislature that this was a problem?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware. I wasn't there, so I don't know what they said.
Representative Albright.
Commissioner, you mentioned in your kind of comments that there's a coordination between the four constitutional officers and the State Board of Investment. They're delegating their responsibilities to the SBI.
No.
You know, my question is, were those officers informed of these deliberations or these negotiations? So where does the information, you know, stop and start in terms of coordination from the leadership in the executive branch down to the SBI?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, the discussions between the SBI and its members were between the SBI and its members. I'm not aware of what those discussions were or when those disclosures were made. That's between the SBI and the people who sit on that board.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Albright,
the board representing the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and the state auditor, those would be the people involved in those negotiations.
Mr. Chair, they sit on the board, so I'm not saying they were involved in negotiations. I don't know what the nature of the conversations were between the SBI and its board members.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
So, but they would hold meetings or minutes from those meetings that would surround the deliberations and informing them of the negotiations, confidential or otherwise, to settlement on this issue. Would that be correct?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I simply wasn't there. I'm not sure what the procedures are.
Okay, but I guess, Commissioner, for purposes of what you're proposing or what you're saying you've implemented as a policy, you're saying that there are times in your view where certain information must be kept confidential. Does that mean it's also kept confidential from the members of that investment board, the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and auditor?
Mr. Chair, I don't represent the State Board of Investment, and I'm not sure what procedures they use to inform their board members. I'm simply talking about the disclosure by MMB to the legislature of payments made pursuant to Section 641.
Okay, but Commissioner, I'm just trying to understand. You've said that there are, in your views underneath your policy, there are if there's an ongoing action where you have self-reported to the IRS a future penalty such as this, you're saying that you may not feel, well, you're not planning on disclosing the fact that you've reported something like this to the IRS until after you've settled. But you're saying you can't do that because of confidentiality issues. But are you going to disclose that to the regular members of the state's investment board, such as the governor?
Mr. Chair,
you're saying you have to keep it confidential.
Mr. Chair, this information was reported to the State Board of Investment when it was discovered these bonds were purchased improperly, and they were told to refrain from not purchasing those bonds, and the SBI was informed of the negotiations. I do not know what SBI did exactly with that information with respect to their board. That was not a function that MMB was responsible for.
Okay, and I'm not, I guess I'm disappointed that we learned about this as late in the game as we did, and that we learned about it in the way that we did, in terms of just happening to have an alert person see it in the report. But I guess I'm really talking more about the future now, in terms of, you know, you've implemented this policy, and the policy that you have implemented says the legislature finds out after a settlement and payment has been made, and I guess you're saying we can't find out before then that there's a problem because you feel like there's a confidentiality issue, and I'm just trying to figure out, well, then, who can be told? Apparently, a number of other people besides the legislature can be told is what I think you're telling me.
Mr. Chair, I'm simply saying that this requires notification, doesn't prohibit notification in those cases where there's no confidentiality requirement. There may not be, in some cases, a confidentiality requirement. In that case, disclosure could happen earlier. I'm simply saying this procedure, no matter what the disclosure requirements are or are not with the IRS, this would require notification of the appropriate legislative and Office of Legislative Auditor entities at a certain point in time to make sure it happens at that time.
All right, Commissioner. Well, I think I understand your policy that you're proposing. I'm not sure that I agree with it, but in the interest of time, why don't we have you continue? And I know I have someone from the State Board of Investment here that I want to bring up to briefly take questions as well. So go ahead, Commissioner.
Well, we're on the slide showing the changes in the November and February forecast process improvements. What we're doing here is to make some changes in the expenditure forecast so that this payment would have been reported earlier than the November 2015 forecast. As I was mentioning, prior to this February, our process for determining forecast expenditure data for the current fiscal year relied on agencies to communicate exceptions to fiscal year closing data. This process worked for most transactions, but it could miss transactions that were out of the ordinary. Beginning with this February forecast 2016, we are basing our forecast expenditure data on system-generated reports for all accounts. We believe that this system-generated report will ensure that all transactions that are in any agency will be incorporated into our fund statements so that it would have captured this particular payment back in November 2014, and it would have been reported at that time. The last improvement that I want to mention is an internal control self-assessment tool. As you may recall, as I was talking about the Office of Legislative Auditor and their recommendation was that we needed better controls, and one of the things we've done here is to require that the head of each executive agency that's responsible for designing and maintaining their control system, we've added some new mechanisms to that. So now, with the new changes, the goals we've added is that management has procedures and reporting mechanisms in place to monitor variances from budget, spending plans, and dedicated revenue estimates. We're asking agencies to take corrective action as needed and report major changes, uncommon transactions, or issues to the appropriate oversight agency, which could be MMB or the legislature. What we wanted to do here, and this is on every agency's internal control checklist, is to make sure that if they have some uncommon transaction that they feel needs to be reported, they should report it to the correct legislative body or committee and to the oversight agency, in some cases MMB. Another goal that we changed is a goal number 20. We said that agency officials must meet and, we've added, and communicate regularly with the legislature, oversight agencies, which would be the MMB, oversight committees or oversight boards to discuss major issues affecting operations, internal controls, performance, finances, including uncommon transactions, and other major agency initiatives and programs. So the idea here is to put on every agency's internal control sheet a requirement that they review these uncommon transactions to see if they should be reported to the legislative body involved and or to MMB or some other oversight agency. So I think the key was what we've been trying to do is to commit to improving the transparency of these payments is to make sure that we have a new statewide policy regarding purchase of state bonds. We make sure that we have a compliance certification on the purchase of state bonds to make sure that's not happening. We've added guidance so that these uncommon transactions, such as the IRS penalty, are required to be disclosed by all agencies. We've created an internal new policy at MMB to make sure that the payments that are tied to these IRS payments are reported immediately. We've created a new internal MMB procedure to the November and February forecast process to make sure that they're reported in the date and the expenditure data on a more timely basis. I am disappointed that the IRS penalty payment was not reported earlier, and I want to make sure that you understand that we're committed to improving transparency, and we intend to continue with these improved transparency transactions, and we're happy to take suggestions or comments about making those even better. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner, I've been studying the language here and talking with Mr. Marks about it, and looking at the rest of the section in addition to the subdivision that you have printed here in the handout, and I am struggling with the notion that you have authority to make this payment from this particular subdivision. The entire subdivision is written in the context of arbitrage, which we talked about earlier. There's nothing in here talking about a penalty for what happens when the government messes up.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's nothing in the statute limiting the authority of the MMB to make compliance transaction payments.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, you believe that the MMB's got the authority to do pretty well anything under this statute if it doesn't prohibit them from acting? If it isn't expressly prohibited in this particular statute, you can do that, and that would suggest you can do other things. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is, under the circumstances, we interpreted this statutory language to give us clear authority to make the IRS payment for this particular transaction.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, have you, this interpretation was provided by your department only, or who provided it, and did you seek an outside opinion from someone? Has there been an effort to seek declaratory judgment on this to see what the courts have to say?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no.
Well, Commissioner, I struggle with that, and I've looked at the rest of that section. As I mentioned, there's some other places in that section, including sale and issues of bonds, subdivision 4, the original authority in subdivision 1, and other places that if the legislature truly would have suggested that there was an area dealing with penalties, that those are the areas that intuitively that language would have appeared. This, again, if you read this subdivision 6 contextually, every word of it is contextually relating back to arbitrage. Every single word of that subdivision, as I read it. So I struggle with the department's interpretation. And then I would ask Mr. Chair and Commissioner, what is, given this reality, Commissioner, what is the penalty that the government serves in this situation? What penalty does your agency absorb from this, we'll just say, mistake?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, it's $530,000. What where does that money come from, and what spending reductions will you be making in your budget or other places in state government in order to account for the government misusing or not following statute with the people's money?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the penalty was paid out of the general fund, and the methods that we are trying to establish here will, we believe, ensure that this particular situation will not happen again. That's about all we can do at this time, is to make sure we have procedures in place, we review these bond purchases, we make sure that the agencies certify that they're not making improper purchases, to make sure this doesn't happen again. And that's what we're trying to do, is to ensure it doesn't happen again.
Commissioner, when you say it was paid out of the general fund, can you be more specific? Was this paid out of, like, the MMB, out of MMB, out of their general administration fund, out of a particular account within MMB? Where was the money paid from?
Mr. Chair, I can't be more specific. I can get that answer for you. I don't have that information right now.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Drazkowski.
If I could, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, is there any element of government at this point that is going to be decreased in their budget in order to offset this unanticipated $530,000 penalty?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the clearly this payment of the penalty, Representative, that occurred in November of 2014 or September of 2014 was accounted for in this last, in the November forecast, and so it was the overall fund adjustment was made in the November 2015 forecast, and their accounts have been adjusted accordingly.
So Mr. Chair,
Representative Drazkowski.
And this is a final kind of question or maybe comment. One question would be, Commissioner, and then I'll have a comment. Maybe you can chew on the question. But do you plan, does the department plan to bring forward proposals, ideas to bring clarity to this should it happen again in the future? Is that part of your policies and discussion around this, or do you truly believe that it's fully responsible for us to relate to this language in Subdivision 6 that, again, I mentioned is very, very squishy. But I would offer this as a comment. I've been visiting with businesses and individuals throughout Minnesota. I was most recently last week to the Sunrise Cafe in Malmo. And Lori Westerl in there runs the cafe. And in order for her to pay her state general tax to her little cafe and convenience store, she has to sell 6,400 pies per year, slices of pie per year at $2.65 a slice to pay that tax. And Commissioner, $530,000 is 120 Sunrise Cafes in Minnesota that pay that money each year. She pays $4,400 to the state government of the state of Minnesota and struggles to survive with her business on the corner there. And we simply go along and just pay the fine out of what appears to not even be authority to do it. I'm rather frustrated at the direction we're going, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Commissioner, and then I've got Representative Anderson and Representative Kahn, and then I think I'd like to have Mr. Mansco Perry come up from the State Board of Investment. Representative Anderson.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Franz, in the statute language that you cite, you say that it says there that it's subject to the approval of the Attorney General. So where would I find that approval? The AG approved of doing this?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the approval that you're talking about in the first paragraph there talks about the when the commissioner certifies the series of bonds for sale. So there's always a process by which the Attorney General reviews the preparation and sale of bonds, and that is the approval process that we're talking about there when the bonds are initially ready for sale.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Franz, I'm still looking, though, for that approval, because if these bonds were sold that were purchased, they purchased these bonds, that would have still fallen under this statute that you have here. So where would I find the Attorney General approving the purchase of state bonds from the SBI?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I was suggesting that the approval is for the issuance of the sale of the bonds in the first and primary instance. So, for example, last November we sold a little over $1 billion in bonds, and before we can do that, we have to make sure that the bonds that we're selling meet all the statutory constitutional conditions, and it's that approval that we have when they're initially sold. It's not when they're later purchased.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner France, that gets back to the whole issue altogether, though. We did something illegally, and that would have been approved by the Attorney General, because that statute says here that they have to approve that. So where would I find that?
What?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's not what the statute says at all, Representative. What the statute provides is that the Attorney General's office provides oversight and approval of the preparation and sale of bonds, and that is their role. But they are not involved in the later purchase by a different agency of those bonds. That's not part of what they do.
Okay, I've got Representative Kahn.
Well, a couple of questions. Commissioner Franz, when did you become commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, seems like a long, long time ago.
Wow.
But it was January of 2015.
When did all of this take place?
It took place prior to that, but, you know, nonetheless, I'm concerned about
it. I just thought that ought to be part of the discussion, too. And the other thing, you know, this is terribly complicated, and I'm not sure I'm up to following all of it, but I do understand at some point there was a line in the report that said that this was happening.
Yeah, this last
November. That we saw.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it should not have been a surprise to any of the members of this group. If they had read this report that was before us thoroughly, they should have seen it in November.
Well, we did see it in November. There was publicity about it in November. We haven't had a hearing. I did not have a hearing after the November forecast came out. So this is the first time that we have had a hearing since then. And so I thought it was an appropriate time to bring it up.
Okay, but the point was, I thought that the line had appeared before the issue even came up. That what had happened, the activity, had been in a report before the issue came up. I thought.
No. It only came out in the November forecast.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Mr. Perry. Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. I don't expect we're going to spend nearly as much time with you on this as we just did with the commissioner, because I do want to get on to the budget forecast. But I appreciate you being here. I guess, first of all, do you have anything else you want to say? I don't know if you had any kind of a prepared testimony. You don't have to. Otherwise, I've got a couple questions for you, and I know some other people do. But if you want to make any kind of a opening statement or anything, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, I have no prepared remarks.
Okay. All right. And Mr. Perry, I know that you're, why don't you, for the same question that Representative Kahn had, why don't you tell us when you took over as the, the executive officer or the head of the State Board of Investment?
I became executive officer, Mr. Chair, I became executive director and chief investment officer on October 21st, 2013.
Okay. All right. Mr. Perry, I guess maybe I can ask you, even though this was before you became executive director, can you tell us how this happened?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that the bonds were bought pursuant to following statutory language which allowed the purchase of municipal bonds by the State Board of Investment. Unfortunately, the agency was unaware of the IRS regulation which would have prohibited the purchase of the bond. They were purchased at somewhat of a discount, and that's why they were seemed to be attractive. But my understanding is that there was no awareness of the IRS statute, which is problematic, I'm sure.
Was this a new IRS regulation that just come out or something? It seems kind of surprising that the agency wouldn't have been aware of something like this.
I do not believe it was new. I'm just reporting what my understanding is as to why it happened.
Okay. Mr. Perry, do you know how much money did we make on selling the bonds? I guess we must have made some money on them. Do you know how much that was?
No, I don't have the exact figures, but it was purchased as part of the $10 billion pool of assets that we have for cash.
Is it fair to say we made less than $537,000?
Given the timing of this, I'd say it would be in that ballpark.
I'm sorry, you're saying you think we made around $537,000?
I would think that it would be, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I would think it would be, that we've made somewhat less than that.
All right. If you could, excuse me, I think I'd be interested in knowing how much money we did make so I could just kind of get a sense of what was our sort of net loss on this as a state. You could have some staff member figure that out.
We can figure that out, yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that raises a question kind of linked to that, which is, can you give us any explanation, or maybe the commissioner, of how this number was arrived at as a penalty? Is that related to, is it, I know you described before about the foregone payment of interest and so on. Is that what this penalty represents, or is there something, some other calculation in there?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is part of the calculation. It's a good question. I don't have the exact calculation, and we'll put it together for you. But part of what the IRS is concerned about, and they don't like the original purchase by a state agency of a state bond, but they really don't like the sale of it because that, because in their view, it becomes a taxable bond, and they should be getting the interest off that the payments off of that taxable bond. So what happens is when they figure the penalty, they do in fact take a look at what kind of income was foregone in that situation. I know that's part of the formula, but that's as much detail as I know. But we can dig that out for you.
Okay, Representative Albright and then Mahoney.
Mr. Perry, on the handout that Commissioner Franz gave, he provided a policy that was dated February 8th that talks about the prohibition in purchase of particular bonds. I guess in op-ed I find it interesting that in the first sentence that rather than should avoid, we wouldn't just say shall not, given the fact that that's what the policy is for. But my question to both of you, and you can both take a shot at it, is it seems like this is a pretty short list. My first question is, does this list change from time to time based upon the tax code, understandably, or with that in mind, is the what went wrong that we didn't look at this list before we made those purchases?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's the list of those agencies that issue, that have the authority to issue bonds. The list of the agencies that receive the policy is much longer. It's all state agencies and in addition a number of other authorities that have the ability to purchase bonds or through a trustee purchase bonds. So there's a pretty large list of entities that receive that policy. So, and actually we will monitor that every year. We don't think it'll change too much. It's a fairly static list. But we will monitor that every year when we send it out to make sure the list is as complete as we can possibly make it. But it's a bigger list that it goes out to. I didn't include the mailing list here.
Representative Albright. And I'm going to pick up on something that Representative Anderson said in terms of the Attorney General's role in verification of what is appropriate. She goes through, the person holding that office certainly goes through and determines the appropriateness for issuance of the bonds. But I think Representative Anderson's question goes to, in the secondary markets, once they're issued, the appropriateness for purchase into a various account or whatnot. Would the Attorney General, along with the other three members of the board, review those as well? And given her legal background, wouldn't it be incumbent on her to review that as well? I'm just trying to get a sense for the involvement of the constitutional officers in setting policy for the SBI.
Mr. Perry or Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, the State Board of Investment staff in consultation with our consultant prepare a list of policies that we follow. Unfortunately, this was not covered. So the members of the State Board of Investment do receive a copy of this, and ultimately they're responsible for approving the list. But they do not, they're not involved in the day-to-day handlings of the execution of those policies.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Even though you may not meet with them regularly for the day-to-day operations, they still are fiduciaries for the monies over which you are been delegated to oversee. So on what basis do you meet with them to apprise them of what's going on within the purview of their responsibilities overseeing these amount, these accounts?
Or Perry.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, we have a quarterly board meeting, and I meet with the individual board members at least once during the quarter prior to that meeting to apprise them as to what's going on in the office and in preparation for the board meeting. And on a fairly regular basis, I meet with a designee from each of their offices and let them know what's going on.
So, the
Representative Albright.
So in the context of the negotiations revolving this oversight, were you apprising those constitutional officers of those negotiations? Were they made aware of it? And in the context of a quarterly board meeting, were those in the minutes from those board meetings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I was not a party to the negotiations, nor was my predecessor. My predecessor, Mr. Bicker, informed me of the violation, and subsequent to that, I was made aware that the prior commissioner of MB was having discussions, but essentially I was told that discussions were taking place, that they were confidential, and that there was nothing for me to speak to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Perry, can you tell us when did you find out that this was an issue at the State Board of Investment? Mr. Perry, when did you find out it was an issue at the State Board of Investment?
Mr. Chair, I was apprised that there had been a violation in discussions I had with Mr. Bicker early on in my tenure there. I did not hear anything about negotiations until they were taking place. And I think it was probably near the end of the discussions. I was asked whether or not I knew about it, essentially. I gave an affirmative answer, but that was not part of the negotiations.
Okay, I'm going to go to Mr. Mahoney, and then I'm going to bring up Mr. Nobles, and then we need to kind of wrap this up and get on to the forecast. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's good that we're going to get on to the forecast. I missed the last Friday. Actually, all I want to know is, you brought up an interesting point. You know, if we made money on these bonds and the sale of that, and the IRS takes into consideration any tax loss, but also they probably take in profit. I guess I'm not sure to call it profit or not. But so when you figure out the request of the chair, I would also like to know that information. So if you could pass that along to the rest of us, so you know, at some point at the end of the day, if you do the numbers and it comes out to the penalty was $37, the per diems don't cover that, or I guess the per diems would cover that, and we've spent a lot of the taxpayers' money going over a number of things. But if it's $537 and you've put into place, just like when I'm a pipe fitter, if somebody drops a pipe, we spend about 10 minutes trying to figure out why they dropped the pipe, and we try to get the pipe back in the rack. So I'm just like to know what this cost in its reality.
Well, I'll go ahead and make sure that we have staff distribute the answer we get back to all members. That's pretty standard. And I guess, you know, I think, you know, there's a couple of concerns here. There's another kind of legal concern that I think maybe comes up in a minute here. But I guess I have a couple of concerns here. A, in that we simply found out about it in the way we found out about it without being told about it. Yes, mistakes happen, but if there are mistakes, I guess we'd like to be able to hear about them. And I do have some concern that apparently in the future we're not going to underneath the policy that's here find out about mistakes until after they're all settled. And I kind of question whether that's the right policy, but I guess I'll have to learn some more about it. Mr. Nobles, could you come forward? And we'll take some testimony from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and then again, I am sensitive to the fact that, yep, we want to get on to the forecast, too. And Mr. Nobles, I know I've got a question or two for you, but do you want to make any kind of a statement on this first?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor, and with me at the table is Cecile Furkel, who is the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division. Mr. Chairman, I would just like to set a preface for some comments that Ms. Furkel is going to make. We are the auditor of state government, as you know, and one of the important responsibilities we have as a matter of law is every year to audit the state's financial statements. It was just referred to, officially called the CAFR, the Comprehensive Report on the State's Financial Condition. That's a very important part of what we do. And I would say the general overriding purpose of a CAFR is disclosure, disclosure, disclosure. Disclosure to a lot of people, to you, to citizens, but I think in particular to credit rating agencies, to bond buyers. They go through this document quite carefully. Maybe some of you do as well. I would commend it to you. It's rather large. It's rather detailed. And I'm glad for it to get a little bit of exposure today because the Department of Management and Budget and the Office of Legislative Auditors spend a good deal of time every year. Our role, of course, is to ensure that the numbers in here are compiled and presented according to generally accepted accounting principles, but also that the disclosures are made. And this all began for us when I received a phone call back in December from a member, a staff person who is sitting at the table with you. If he wants to be recognized, we certainly would. I appreciated the phone call. But it really caught me by surprise because we had just finished the audit of the state's financial statements, and supposedly at that point, we know everything about what is going on in state government and that all the disclosures and the notes have been discussed with us and made according to what is required. So I got a call and was asked, Mr. Nobles, are you aware that the state of Minnesota paid a penalty to the IRS? And I had to say no, that didn't make me feel right. As legislative auditor, it seems to me I should have known that. So if I did not know that, certainly I thought Ms. Furkel should know that because there are a lot of things that I don't know, but she does. And so I immediately walked over to her office, and again, this comes in the context that we have just written our audit opinion on the state's financial statements. So supposedly we know everything that is supposed to be disclosed and has been, and that it has been disclosed if it's supposed to be disclosed. So I ask Ms. Furkel, do you know, in the context of doing this audit, that the state had paid a penalty to the IRS? And she said no. And I must say that was alarming to both of us, that we have issued an audit opinion to the state of Minnesota that is just about to be published, and we are learning something at that late hour, not from MMB, but from a member of the House of Representatives staff. So I'd like Ms. Furkel just to tell you a little bit more about what happened. But just in case she doesn't mention this, I think it's very relevant. I do commend you to go back to your offices and get a copy of the financial statements at the CAFR. And one of the things that was brought up is that, well, we can't really tell you until we know exactly how many dollars are involved. Well, the fact is that within the CAFR, we disclose litigation that has not been resolved or settled. Note 10 lists many cases that are pending where the state might have a liability, but we don't know. One other point I would mention is that as a legislative auditor, we are supposed to know a lot of things, frankly, that you can't be told because they are confidential. So on the question of whether or not there was a confidentiality requirement that kept MMB from telling you, that is not the case with the legislative auditor. We very explicitly in state law have the authority to see all documents, all information, regardless of classification. In fact, we go over to the Department of Revenue frequently and examine tax returns as a part of our responsibility. So we have that authority, and we expect to know whether it's classified as not public or not. So if, Mr. Chairman, and we are very aware that you want to get to the forecast, but I'd like Ms. Ferkel just to fill in a few more details, if I could, Mr. Chairman, and thank you.
Ms. Ferkel, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. I'm Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor. As Jim already explained, we heard about this issue within hours of having released the opinion to MMBDUs. And when I first heard about it, because of its connection to bonds, to general obligation bonds, and my knowledge that our financial report that we provide an opinion on, a primary user of that report is the bond rating agencies and is the bond community. It's a big document, and not a lot of people wade into this, but a lot of people rely on my signature and Jim's signature that what they read in here fairly presents the financial position of the state and disclosures that are relevant and required to be disclosed. So it was very concerning to me, and after contacting MMB and getting more information about what the payment was for, I asked for a copy of the settlement agreement, and after reviewing that, I felt that we needed to pull back the opinion and get more information to make sure that a disclosure, if it was required, that a disclosure was included. I did in that email say that either we would release the opinion once the transaction was adequately disclosed or until we had more information to understand that didn't need to be disclosed. Over the next 24 hours, we worked out the disclosure language. It got into the CAFR, and we provided our opinion back again, and everything was published by the deadline. So that was a good thing. But what was interesting to me was that after the fact, when we brought this issue up through a report that we issued earlier this month, MMB asserted to us that they didn't think the disclosure was necessary, that they had fully vetted this issue already with bond counsel, with other consultants and advisors that they had, and that they didn't feel it needed to be disclosed. And that just was so interesting to me, because that was never brought up to me at the point that we were making decisions about whether or not the disclosure needed to happen. And when I asked for documentation of those analyses or opinions or advice provided, none of those decision points were documented. Nothing has been provided, and we've been told that it was all done through verbal discussion. So all of that really concerned me. A lot of our audit work, I'm sure you understand, we don't look at every single transaction in the state's financial statements. We look at what we feel is going to be necessary in order to give the opinion that we give. And when this seems to have been not considered relevant for discussion to the OLA, that concerned me at the time. And again, I in an email informed MMB that there were opportunities to bring this up to us. In fact, just within days of this becoming an issue, we had asked MMB management to sign a letter to us asserting that they had disclosed to us all issues of noncompliance that were relevant to the financial statements. And they had signed that letter again without disclosing that to us. So I know that this will impact the way that we do our work in the future and the way that we work with MMB and making sure that we do have all of the relevant information that we need so that we won't find ourselves kind of backed up against the wall in a situation like we did here.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one final thing, because it was brought up that this occurred when Commissioner Franz was not the commissioner. And I think that is a relevant point, because I have to say that Commissioner Franz and I have had a very good relationship. He is in my office fairly frequently, or I'm up in his. We're in the same building, which kind of facilitates that. He's appropriately up on a higher level in that building than I am, has a better view. But Commissioner Franz and I, and he has tenure as commissioner, and in fact, as I walked in the room, he said he needs to come visit with me about another issue. So it was a bit of a surprise that this had not been disclosed. I don't know that that Commissioner Franz knew that to disclose to me, frankly, because it did occur before he was there. But I think in fairness, because he's here to take the brunt of this criticism, which I think is appropriate for the institution of the department, for the executive branch, but just think it needs to be said that in terms of the relationship that the Office of Legislative Auditor has with Commissioner France, it's quite good and professional. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I have Representative Carlson and Representative Anderson. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, my question is to Mr. Nobles. You referenced in your testimony that state law provides that you have access to all documents. And when Commissioner France was testifying, he indicated that the IRS requires that there be certain confidentiality. And so just how does that work when you're doing an audit? And I'm asking the question in a general way, not just necessarily this issue, but it seems to me that there's kind of a bind here between federal law, federal requirement, federal rule, whatever that comes down as, and what our state law says you have access to. So if you could expand a little bit on, do you have free and open access even if the IRS says that there is to be confidentiality? Because then it appears we've got a state and federal issue here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, we see federal documents that are classified as not public virtually every day. And we have, on occasion, had agencies tell us that they could not give us something because of a federal law or federal requirement. And we simply read to them our statute, which says that the legislative auditor has access to all books, accounts, documents, data of any classification that we need to see. And we have never been denied any documents of any classification classified either by the courts, by the federal government, or by state law.
Okay, that's one of the reasons I asked that question, because it it did appear on the face of it that there would be potentially a conflict with what the IRS is requiring in terms of confidentiality. But you're saying you would be in the circle under state law, and the federal government doesn't argue that point then, apparently, and if you've got access, you've got access, and they allow it.
Mr. Chairman, Resident Carlson, that is, again, correct. Just to reiterate, we are in the Department of Revenue. Commissioner France, a former Commissioner of Revenue, knows that we often interact with federally classified documents and are often, frankly, involved in situations of potential litigation where we are aware of something that is developing that has not yet been disclosed at all. So, yes, we are within that circle.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Ferkel, so you were told by MMB that they notified the bond councils but not the legislature? Is that what they said that they...
Mr. Chair, they, at the time that it was happening, I believe that bond council was a part of the negotiating the settlement with the IRS. I think that they were involved in that discussion all along. I think MMB perhaps can respond to that, but that was the impression that I got.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add, if you read any of our reports, you know that documentation is very important. Auditors come into situations, very complex situations often, of legal interpretation. And you too here today ask what kind of documentation of any legal opinion interpreting statute. I think it's just good practice, and I think it is the common practice that when agencies go through a situation that is of some importance, and I don't think anybody would deny that dealing with the IRS, facing a penalty, being alleged to have violated an IRS penalty, is a serious matter. And so if you are communicating with the IRS and communicating with bond counsel, and I've reviewed many bond counsel opinions, we do audits of GO bonds compliance, and so we often see bond counsel, frankly, I might add, in addition to the question that Representative Carlson asked, we see opinions that are marked attorney-client privilege as well. Even if there has been a bond counsel that is privileged as to attorney-client privilege, we will exercise our authority to see that. So I was a little bit surprised that on a matter of such importance that it was left to verbal, oral communication and not documented.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Thank you, Ms. Ferkel. Unless there are other questions, I think let's get on with the forecast. But this is an important topic, and we do appreciate everyone's testimony today. Commissioner Franz, ready?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I assume you all have this handout, the budget February 2016 handout, with the budget outlook stable despite slower growth in the first page. We'll start.
We'll start there. We've got this too.
Okay, good. So we have the book and the slide. So what we'd like to do, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, is I'd like to just sort of walk through some of the initial numbers, but frankly, the more interesting testimony is by my colleague, Professor Columbakidis, in terms of the economic issues that we're facing and the outlook, and then and Budget Director Kelly will provide some information about the budget process. So what I'll do is I'll just kick off the first slide or two and then turn it over to Professor Columbakidis. But I think if you look at the first slide, the budget outlook stable despite slower growth. What we wanted to convey here was an understanding that the new balance, the 2016-2017 forecast balance, is now $900 million. The U.S. economic outlook has weakened, and we're seeing some slower expected economic growth in our, and reduced our tax revenue forecast. We're seeing some savings in medical assistance that reduce our overall spending, and that our slower growth continues in the long-term budget outlook, but we positive structural balance remains in the future. So let's do the numbers on the next page, if you will. So if you look at the slide that says 2016-2017 budget balance.
Commissioner, just for the sake on, for the benefit of everyone on the committee, why don't you hold up the document that you're referring to? I think there might be some confusion in terms of, at least on my part, what we're looking at.
Yeah.
Members, do we all have that?
Got it? Nope.
No, let's hold on and make sure we're all on the same page before you continue. I think we're missing some copies.
It's the overhead one, I think. That
okay.
Oh.
Okay. Is it this one?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I thought.
I think we're...
actually, I can hand out one. Here.
This one? Members, do we all have the large unabridged edition of Commissioner Franz's?
Here's another one.
It would contain the same, and for the sake of brevity, I don't know that we need to go into there, but I think it is important that we're all looking at the same slides.
I have the big book.
I'll just give them away, but here's the big one.
Commissioner, can you correlate to the large...
to the book?
To the book.
In some ways. So I think actually...
I think
you go
Representative Mahoney suggested you might be starting on page 4.
The book? Yes, if you go to page 4 of the book, Mr. Chair, you'll see a chart up there that says the current biennium general federal general fund budget. So that's where I'm going to talk about the numbers right now.
Are we all there yet?
No.
All right. Commissioner, why don't you proceed based upon using the large book, and we'll try to make sure that we remind members of what page we're on as we progress.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Appreciate it. Sorry we don't have more copies. So if you look at that chart on the top of page 4 in the big book, clearly what we're seeing is the beginning balance, of course, hasn't changed with the beginning of the biennium, but we're seeing the revenues in the second line there go down about $427 million, or 1% drop, and we're seeing the expenditures also go down about 0.3% drop in expenditures. So this is a little forecast math, but those two parentheticals are netted against one another. So at the bottom of that column change, you see $306 million change. That's the reduction that we're seeing from the November forecast, which was $1.2 billion, and now we're seeing a forecast balance of $900 million. So I think at this point we're ready to jump into the economic discussion, but I'm not sure. Yeah, what page?
Why
don't you move over here?
I'm going to start.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And just for formality's sake, if you could again state your name for the record and remind us of what page in the big book we're starting from.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Laura Columbakidis. I'm the state economist. I'm going to start with a chart that is appears at the bottom of page 2 in the book, so it's a chart of real GDP growth. And in the handouts, it is slide 3, I think. Slide 3 in the handout. So I'm going to start with how the U.S. economic outlook has changed since the November forecast. I'm going to talk a little bit about Minnesota's situation and how that informs the revenue forecast. So a slow finish to 2015, mostly due to reduced energy-related business investment, has weakened the U.S. outlook since our forecast was prepared last November. While some of the factors that slowed growth last year are expected to wane or dissipate by the middle of this year, particularly that depressed oil-related investment, ongoing weakness in global economies and the strong U.S. dollar will prove more persistent drags in oncoming years, in the next several years. So the chart shows annual percent change in U.S. real GDP. Both the history, the dark bars are the history, and the February outlook from our macroeconomic consulting firm, IHS Economics. The light bars show the November outlook, which, of course, was the outlook that informed our November forecast. So in their February forecast, IHS has lowered their overall expectations for growth for the years in our planning horizon. IHS now calls for annual real GDP to grow at the same rate in 2016 as it did in the last 2 years, so 2.4%. Their November outlook, as you can see, had higher growth of 2.9% this year. Again, the overall lower our outlook is largely because 2016 slowed down and lowered the base for the subsequent years. But as the drag from that reduced business investment fades, some of the positives in the U.S. economy regarding consumers, those positives are supposed to pick up, and those kinds of things are steady job gains, low energy prices, modest consumer price inflation. All of those things together should support real income growth, and real income growth should support consumer spending and home building activities. So those things, the consumer factors, those things are expected to bring economic activity back up to a moderate pace starting later this year and then going into 2017. So that's the change from the 2.4% growth in 16 to the 2.8% growth in 17. That bit of acceleration is because some of the negatives are fading and the positives of the consumer-based positives are taking over.
Ms. Columbakidis, I'm going to just pause you for a second. I think Representative Carlson has a question.
I guess I'd ask you on the procedure. Do you want us to ask questions
as we're
going through?
I think for the time we've got left in the committee meeting, Representative Carlson, if we could just refrain until...
Sure. I had a question on that chart, but I can wait. Then if that's your...
You're certainly welcome to ask it now if it helps us all.
Maybe, when we look at 16 and we go from 2.9 to 2.4...
Mm-hmm.
There's a variety of way forecasts are done, and is there general consensus on the 2.4, or would there be some forecasters that might say that we should be even more cautious and look at a lower number? I know you kind of massaged the economic advisors' conversations, is the way I'll put it, but... There's more than one forecast that's out there, and I was just curious as to whether there's consensus on how we arrive at the 2.4, whether some economists or others might want us to exercise more cautious.
Ms. Pumpkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, we talk about that issue or that the where the IHS forecast falls within the consensus of other macroeconomic forecasters. And of course, there are a lot of them, and they do their forecasts in different ways. But again, on page 2 of the book, we write about that a bit. And so one way to look at where IHS is relative to other forecasters is to look at the blue chip consensus, which is the consensus or survey of about 50 top business forecasters. And IHS is toward the top. In the top 10 or so of those forecasts. The consensus or the average among the blue chip forecasters is for 2.1% growth in 2016.
Okay, and that's, Mr. Representative Carlson, that's what I was interested in, what kind of a range or what kind of an average there would be. So you're saying the average is actually lower than the 2.4 then, and it would be the average is 2.1.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, that's correct. And that discussion is on page 2, and there's further discussion of that in our printed Council of Economic Advisors statement, which is also in the book, in the forecast book. So the on that same line, the IHS February economic outlook depends on a number of things. So there are a number of dependencies to this forecast, the things that IHS expects to happen in order for this forecast to materialize. Particularly, IHS expects global growth to improve. So global growth has been and continues to be a drag on U.S. Economic growth, and that global growth improving should allow the value of the U.S. dollar to begin a slow multi-year descent later this year. And I'll talk a bit more about the U.S. dollar in a minute. An improved growth in foreign economies, so as they grow, they'll demand more oil. At the same time, IHS expects oil production to slow. And so those two factors should rebalance rebalance the oil market and permit a gradual recovery in oil prices later this year. IHS also acknowledges that we are in an extraordinary period of adjustment with regard to U.S. monetary policy, as the Federal Reserve has increased their target for the federal funds rate at the end of last year, up from near zero level that it's been for a number of years. So as the Fed is making this adjustment from a long period of accommodative monetary policy to more normal monetary policy, IHS expects that path to go smoothly. They also recognize that recent volatility in financial markets can create what's called a negative wealth effect, which means that consumers who feel that their assets are worth less will spend less. But IHS also recognizes that home values have increased, and so that creates a positive wealth effect. And that offsets some of the negative wealth effect from stock market volatility. So the factors that are shaping the global and U.S. outlooks are also affecting Minnesota. So turning to, you now do have the handout, so slide 5, which is the top of page 3, the one with two charts. We're illustrating two of the external or global factors that are influencing the U.S. economy right now, and I want to talk a bit about their impact on Minnesota. So on the left, you see the dollar exchange rate, and I've talked a bit about what's called the strong dollar. What's happening is the relative strength of the U.S. economy. So the U.S. economy growing moderately, but growing better than many external economies, that relative strength, along with the promise of higher interest rates from the U.S. Federal Reserve moving to more normal monetary policy, those two things are attracting foreign investment into the United States. And foreign investors bringing money into the United States increases demand for U.S. dollars. And so that increases the value of the dollar. What the chart shows is the trade-weighted dollar exchange rate. That means it's weighted by the size of our major trading partners. So the trading partners that are most important to the United States get more weight. The trade-weighted dollar has risen 22% against major trading partners since mid-2014. And a stronger dollar relative to trading partners makes Minnesota-produced goods, including agricultural commodities and natural resource commodities and manufactured goods, makes all of our Minnesota-produced goods more expensive for our foreign customers abroad. So it reduces demand for Minnesota-produced goods. Indeed, the dollar's strength is likely related to the fact that Minnesota's manufacturing activity appears to have cooled. That sector in our forecast is expected to lower employment this year, but we expect that to be followed by a modest job gain next year as global growth is expected to improve. The chart on the right shows oil prices, so prices per barrel of crude oil. Oil prices have fallen more than 70% since mid-2014, and of course this is a mixed blessing. Cheap oil means cheap gasoline, and so that helps consumers at the pump and allows consumers to divert some gas money to something else. In addition, lower oil prices reduces prices of goods that use petroleum to be produced, so it has a general dampening effect on consumer prices. But at the same time, the flip side of that is that it also means lower investment for energy producers. And while Minnesota is not an oil-producing state, we're indirectly affected by that regarding demand for steel, for instance, that's used in oil drilling and exploration. But largely, since we are not an oil-producing state and we're only getting the indirect effect of the reduction in business investment, we do get the benefit of lower gasoline prices and the generally lower consumer prices. So this is an example how Minnesota's economy, which is a diverse economy, how that diversity creates resilience for the state to withstand slowdowns that are especially the result of a particular volatile industry, in this case, the oil sector. Moving on to the slide at the bottom of page 3, so this is slide 6, the one that says Minnesota wage growth forecasts lower. I want to turn to another aspect of Minnesota's economy, and that is the labor market. As we talked about in November, this continues to be the case that Minnesota's labor market continues to tighten up. Meaning, what I mean by tighten up or a tight labor market is that it exhibits low unemployment and high demand for workers. Steady job growth has helped push the unemployment rate down to 3.5% in December. That's one of the lowest among states that have a large metropolitan area. Fewer people are being laid off. The number of Minnesota's filing new claims for unemployment benefits is very low. And the number of long-term unemployed and part-time workers who would prefer full-time are both down to close to pre-recession levels. So our February 2016 forecast now calls for Minnesota's expansion to continue over the next several years. But as the lower growth in the current U.S. economy, so that lower growth that I showed you in the first chart, as that feeds through to Minnesota, we expect the state's economy to grow at a generally slower rate than what we had expected in November. Regarding the wage forecast, we look at data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, we look at the quarterly census for employment and wages, and we look at Minnesota-specific data on receipts from income tax withholding in order to construct our wage forecast. And one thing that we've learned with that information is that we now estimate that the 2015 wage growth that we had forecast 4.9% in November, we now think that that is 4.7%. So that's a little lower than what we had expected. Also, as I presented in November, Minnesota's job growth is being constrained by the long-awaited slowdown in labor force growth due to baby boom retirements. Because of that, both employment and total wage income growth are expected to remain modest in 16 and 17. So we now expect total wage growth, and so the bar chart that you have at the bottom of page 3 is total wage and salary income, so it's all the wage income of all the workers. We now expect that to be 3.8% this year and then picking back up to 4.7% subsequently. So that lower wage and salary income growth forecast, so it's still growing, it's just a lower growth forecast, that feeds directly into or influences directly our revenue forecast. So turning to page 4, the chart at the top of page 4, the table, I mean, shows the specific pieces of the revenue forecast. total tax revenues for the biennium are now forecast to be $465 million, or $466 million below their prior estimate. That is the result of lower expected individual income, corporate income, sales, and state general property tax receipts. Those bring down the forecast, more than offsetting higher than expected other tax revenues. Generally, the revenue story is pretty simple. Slower forecast growth in economic activity is reducing our expectations for receipts from all major tax types. So they're all moving in the same direction there. And that, and by reducing our expectations for receipts, I mean the forecast is lower than what it had been in November. Individual receipts, that's the $95 million change you see in the table. That change arises from a decrease in our estimate of tax liability for 2014, which is the base year for this forecast. It also includes lower forecast income growth from 2015 to 17. So that includes the wage and salary story I showed you in the prior table, but there are a number of other income classes that we expect to grow more slowly than what we had forecast in November. That includes dividend income, interest income, capital gains income, and business income. The sales tax shows the largest dollar amount decrease. That's the $311 million, so that's the change since the prior forecast. That change reflects lower expected sales tax receipts so far in FY16. So far we have collected, sales tax actual receipts have fallen short of what our November forecast was, and so that helped to lower the sales tax forecast going forward. In addition, we have weaker projected taxable sales growth in calendar year 16 and the first half of 17. So we forecast the pieces of consumer spending and business spending that are taxed under Minnesota sales tax, and those are all forecast to have slower growth than what we had before. And then a slower projected growth in corporate profits reduces the forecast for net corporate tax revenues by $93 million. My final slide is the one titled Forecast Risks, at slide number 8 at the bottom of page 4. So I've touched on most of these, so let me just briefly remind you some of the risks or some of the things that are influencing the economy right now. I talked about gas prices regarding commodity prices, but also low agricultural commodity prices, including hogs, dairy, corn, and soybeans, all took a bite out of farm profits last year. And we have another small decline in farm income in the forecast for 2016. In addition, you're all aware that low iron ore prices have led to a slowdown in job losses on the iron range. Regarding international trade, as I said, IHS expects the economies of our trading partners to begin to recover and the dollar to decline in value this year. The longer it takes for that to happen, the longer manufacturing activity will stay restrained in Minnesota. I talked about the monetary policy story and labor force growth being influenced by the demographic change and the aging out of the workforce of the baby boom population. Capital gains and corporate profits are two most volatile sources of revenue, so even very small changes in the forecast for those could have large changes in revenues. And then finally, with 17 months remaining until the end of the biennium, we still have 72% of forecast receipts outstanding. So any changes in the economic picture between now and then will change the revenue outlook. So I'll pass this on to Budget Director Kelly.
Thank you. I'm going to speak to the slides on page 5, beginning at the top of the page.
Let me just get your name for the record before
we
continue.
Certainly. My name is Margaret Kelly, for the record, State Budget Director, Minnesota Management and Budget.
Ms. Kelly, could we just make sure the mic is more direct to you? Thank you.
Forecast spending is down in the current biennium compared to the November forecast. Spending continues to grow year over year, just at a slightly slower rate. With this forecast, we have a $41.524 billion budget for 16-17 biennium. That's $129 million less than we had forecasted in November. This is just a minor change in spending, only 3/10 of a percentage point change. So like previous forecasts, this change in the forecast is driven by lower spending in the medical assistance program, and specifically the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. HHS spending in that build area is down $130 million from one forecast to the next. Federal legislation in 2015 provided for an enhanced match for states for CHIP expenditures, and in January of this year, additional federal funding to support the enhanced match was made available to states. This represents a 200% increase in funding for Minnesota and has had the effect of lowering state spending by $133 million. So while overall savings continue into the next biennium in the Health and Human Services area, they are offset by higher spending from program enrollment growth in 18 and 19. Looking at education spending, it is slightly up this biennium by $11 million, which is a very small percentage change, less than one-tenth of a percent for the largest area of the state budget. With each forecast, we revise the estimate of the number of students based on actual experience, and this forecast reflects a small increase in students, or pupil counts, as the formula uses. In addition, actual reported special education costs are slightly higher than previously estimated. These two increases in the education area of the budget are offset by lower estimates of the number of children living in poverty. The concentration of poverty is one component of general education funding. This trend reverses in the next biennium. Savings from the slower growth in poverty concentration outstrips the other increases in the education budget itself. Moving on to property tax aids and credits, it's down slightly this biennium by less than one-tenth of 1%. Again, a very small change. Personal income growth in calendar year 2015 contributes to savings in this biennium. However, the slower growth assumed in the economic forecast drives higher spending in fiscal years 18 and 19. Looking at the planning estimates, the slide 10, the bottom of the page there, we're seeing that our revenue reductions that we're seeing in the current biennium continue into the next, an $898 million change in revenues from one biennium to the next, one forecast to the next. Spending change is only $36 million in 18-19. Overall, we continue to have a positive structural balance with $1.184 million on the bottom line, but that's lower than we had in the November forecast when we had $2.045 billion. And again, inflation continues to put pressure on the budget in future years. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Franz?
Maybe I better move over. Thank you. I just want to hit the last slide on page 6, top of the page, and make a few comments, and we can open it up for some questions. One of the things that I want to end on is talking about structural balance. We talk a lot about structural balance in this budget, and a couple of things that we see. We have a forecast balance of $900 million. This biennium, we have a forecast balance of $1.2 billion in the next biennium. And on this last chart, you can see that our forecast revenues are projected to increase on an annual basis at 4.0% per year, and projected spending is projected to go 3.5% per year. This is what we mean by structural balance. One of the things that we've talked a lot about the last several days since our forecast release on Friday, and that is the difference between one-time spending and ongoing spending. And clearly one of the concerns we all have is making sure that whatever spending proposals are made for this particular biennium that we are aware of and cognizant of the $1.2 billion budget that we have, or balance that we have for the next biennium. So we want to be careful and take a close look at one-time spending opportunities, if they exist, versus ongoing spending. The governor, as I think you've heard, will present his budget to the legislature on March 15th, and then we'll obviously get engaged with you all and talk more about how best to reach some compromise or decision about how to solve this particular session. One of the things we do want to mention, the last thing I want to mention before I open it up for questions, is the bonding bill. As you know, we've proposed a $1.4 billion bonding bill. It has fairly small budget costs for this year and the next biennium, and we think it's an opportunity to invest in the future at a fairly low budget cost. And I think one of the things that we want to make sure that we do is provide opportunities to grow. And, you know, we've all talked about making our economy work for more people and more families, and it's certainly something we want to work on with you as we go forward.
But we all have to be mindful that we have some economic indicators that are a little different than we had in November that we need to take into account. So we're looking forward to working with the legislature and the House, Ways and Means here, in terms of coming up with some solutions for this session. With that, I'll open it up for questions.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, or I'm not sure who would answer the question, but going back to the change in the expenditures and looking at the Health and Human Services line where it shows $130 million less spending than we would have than we had expected previously, you may know that recently the legislative auditor did a report, and there was a hearing in the Health and Human Services Finance Committee about the fact that DHS had difficulty for a time in doing eligibility redeterminations, and they and the auditor did sort of estimated that there was, if I'm recalling correctly, about $271 million additional spending. You know, the allegation was that it was wasted money. And I'm just wondering, since we're this is showing that we're saving money in Health and Human Services, and I understand that's from a particular reason, which I wasn't aware of, that there was an increased match for CHIP. But nevertheless, it's sort of striking to me that that additional money isn't showing up in the forecast. And this was for a period, if I'm remembering right, again, I think it was from last January when this would have occurred, but it was an estimate that the OLA did, kind of a projection. They only did a small sampling, and they said, oh, it looks to us like we might have spent up to this large amount of additional dollars because of this failure to do the eligibility, and that isn't showing up here. Can you comment on that?
Ms. Kelly.
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Representative. The comparison that we're making here, a couple of things. One, the comparison we're making here is from forecast to forecast. And so we're comparing what we were projecting in November to what we're projecting now. And the savings that we're showing is attributable to the federal enhanced match around CHIP. In terms of the OLA audit and how that impacts the budget, there are quite a number of system improvements that DHS has made since that audit, and those improvements are all reflected in this forecast. And so we're not anticipating greater savings other than the CHIP savings in this forecast.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let me just be really clear about kind of the point I'm making here, or wondering if I'm correct in my point, and that is that, you know, they were sort of ringing alarm bells about all this additional money that we were spending, and I'm not seeing it here. So, I mean, I know that was an estimate, but it looks to me like that the, you know, the projected, what they were projecting might have turned out to be a bit overblown, because I would think, I mean, that was on a large scale. We're only saving 130 only. $130 million are shown here as a savings. And that was, if I remember right, in the neighborhood of $271 million. So one would think that if that was a real effect, that it would have shown up, right? Because you're tracking all the spending rather carefully, right? And it's not in here.
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, another thing to point out is that this is a general fund forecast mm-hmm. for the Medicaid program. And I believe many of the cases that the OLA audited were Minnesota Care as opposed to Medicaid. And they may have oversampled Minnesota Care, so I think the department questioned the extent to which their findings would apply to the Medicaid program. Mm. But regardless, this forecast deals with the Medicaid program. I think many of the OLA findings were on the Minnesota Care program. There are many system improvements that the Department of Human Services has made since then. I could not answer the extent to which the OLA's finding were reflected in actual payments made as opposed to our projections. The OLA made estimates. The extent to which those estimates materialized in the actual payments made, I can't speak to that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Nornes.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, This may have been mentioned and I might have missed it, but can you clarify of the surplus that we have here in Minnesota, how much went into the reserve fund and what that fund currently would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you.
Commissioner Franz.
As you recall, in the November forecast, we added $595 million to the budget surplus, to the budget account, based on the automatic provision that if there's a balance in the November forecast, 33% of that balance automatically goes into the budget reserve. So that was $594 million. And so right now, as of today, the budget reserve is about almost $1.6 billion. Now, as you know, the MMB has a target of about $2 billion that they would recommend that the budget reserve be added until we get to that point. That does not count the $350 million that we have in a cash account, which is separate from that as well.
Representative Norris.
Just a quick follow-up. Under what circumstances would that money be available? Would it be only when we use up this other reserve?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to let Budget Director, because she has a better handle on that exact requirements than I do.
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the budget reserve is available under a couple of circumstances. One is if there is a budget deficit forecasted, the governor can take action to release money from the reserve to resolve that deficit. It also can be accessed at any point in time. By the legislature, you could make decisions to pull money out of the reserve, but only under certain circumstances under which we would be forecasting a budget deficit in the current biennium can the governor access that legislative action.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I want to go back to that area I was asking about earlier. When I look at the chart, then when we use the blue chip consensus, and thank you for pointing out page 2 for me because I had recalled other discussions, and it is here. But then the blue chip consensus would say instead of 2.4 growth, it should be 2.1 in 16. And then when we look to the out biennium, we're projecting it at growth at 2.8, and the consensus number there in that last line is 2.4. Now, I've got a couple of questions here. First of all, what would that $900 million look like if we were using the blue chip consensus? That $900 million would be some number lower. And if you don't know that offhand, I would appreciate learning that.
Representative Carlson, let me just also draw you to page 69 in the large book. It also gives you some analytics on some of the other forecasts.
I don't think it showed the blue chip consensus, though. Maybe
it does.
Mm-hmm. Does it? Okay. Page 69?
Yes.
And then so that number is there. Okay.
Okay.
And then I'll take a look at that. Then it is available.
This was great reading over the weekend, Representative.
Yeah. The other question then that I have that relates to that is when we look at the out biennium, and I remember the other day during our briefing, Commissioner Franz talked about being careful with future obligations and one-time spending, and we did have a little discussion about inflation at that meeting. I'm talking about where your caucus had a briefing and then we had one as well.
Yep.
And so if we were to look at inflation, and I know you take a look at kind of the bottom line and it's a very rough number, but there are some things that are subject to inflation in the budget, others are not. Some are automatic escalators, others are not. And we've never really gotten what I consider, and they're all going to be estimates, but kind of a better picture of what inflationary costs would be, other than that gross number, where I think it's accurate when I say you kind of take it off the bottom line and just say if we had inflation over the $41-plus million budget, this is what it would cost. And that's really not a
totally accurate picture. So that's a concern that I have. In my personal finances, I've never gotten in trouble by being overly cautious. Maybe I've missed some opportunities, but I still haven't gotten in trouble. And what I, having been here since 98 and been on that roller coaster, Mr. Chairman, as we make decisions, want to make sure we make good decisions and that we not do things that might put us back on that roller coaster, whether it's on the revenue side or whether it's on the spending side. And that's why I point out that the blue chip consensus is lower. And so maybe a question I might have, and we've talked about this in meetings in the past, but what if you were to tell us what the risk factor is with the number that's in this report? You know, high, medium, low, how do you view the risk factor when we look at that one page that you indicated the things that we have to be on alert for?
Yep.
The revenue forecast risks, commodity prices, and so on down the list. And then I have another question in another area, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Columbo-Cletus, and I just wanted to add maybe just a seasoning to that Representative Carlson's referring to slide 8. And you do note four categories that are risks to the economy. And I'm just wondering if, as you answer Representative Carlson's question, if you have any courage to prioritize for us those four in some type of hierarchical area as we kind of contemplate where the emphasis might be in the coming session.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, so to back up to one of Representative Carlson's questions about how different would the revenue change be if we used a lower real GDP growth number for 2016-17. It probably won't surprise you that I don't have an exact answer to that, but it's safe to say we would be forecasting less revenues. But it's also important to remember that we don't tax GDP. And so it's the pieces of GDP that are changing that impact our forecast. So it would depend on if I had someone else's complete U.S. macroeconomic outlook, and I'd have to look at how those pieces changed. For instance, a lower forecast for consumer spending would lower our forecast for general sales tax. A lower forecast for corporate profits would lower our forecast for the corporate franchise tax. The income tax is some of the variables that are within the GDP outlook would influence the income tax, but some of them not so much. For instance, capital gains can go up or down and that does not change GDP. So that's why that's one of the reasons I separate capital gains out as a specific risk, because it's not something that goes into the GDP measure. So I don't have a proportion of if we lowered the GDP forecast by X percent, what that would do to revenues, because it depends on why the GDP forecast is lower. Regarding the risks for the balance of forecast risks, so one of the things you've heard is that the U.S. economic outlook that informs this forecast is above the blue chip consensus, above the consensus of macroeconomic forecasters. So that's a bit of risk. But then there are some risks to that forecast itself. And the Council of Economic Advisors agreed that regarding that balance, that the risks are more on the downside than they are on the upside. So the risk of the U.S. economy growing at this point, the risk of the U.S. economy growing more slowly than IHS forecasts is greater than the promise of the U.S. economy growing faster. And I would agree that at this point, the balance of risks is tilted toward the U.S. economy growing more slowly than what IHS forecasts. And I feel that tilt, that shift, has occurred really since our November forecast, because there have been some economic events that have made things feel more uncertain now than they were in November.
Ms. Columbo-Cletus, on page 40 of the large book, in speaking to the Council of Economic Advisors. I note in the last paragraph on that page that they were fairly strident in their comments about the lack of, or the inconsistency of, not including projected changes in the price of goods. I'm just wondering, I didn't attend the meeting, I think Representative Carlson attended, but I'm wondering if you could expand in terms of the tempo of those comments.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. So as the paragraph on page 40 says, it's the Council of Economic Advisors has made this statement, this argument, consistently since 2003, that the spending side of the budget would, the budget forecast would be more accurate if the spending side included inflation in the increase in the costs of the goods and services that the government purchases. They state that omission makes it harder to understand the budget forecast. Any changes in their statement, though, have been the result of some of our efforts to help them understand the nuances here, that there are some items that do have, and I can let Budget Director Kelly talk about this, that it's not as simple as applying one level of inflation to everything on the expenditure side.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I did have a follow-up, but I'll yield to Member it. I can get it later, then it'll be fine.
We'll put you back on the list. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to test my hearing on this. Did you say, I think I heard you say, and I may be way wrong on this, that you expected more children in poverty with this forecast than your November forecast?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I misspoke, I apologize. The growth in the concentration of students in poverty is slowing.
It's slowing. Okay. And if I could follow up?
Representative Wagenius.
Well, that's good news. So do you have, like, a base number, not in here, but in your underlying work? How many children, say, would be in free and reduced lunch in kindergarten next year, the year after? Do you use that number? Do you have that number?
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, those are embedded in the forecast that the Department of Education prepares for us, and we could ask them for that if you would like that information.
That would be helpful because, Mr. Chairman, when I looked at this years ago when we were doing all-day kindergarten for children, the concentration seemed to be in my city of Minneapolis and the city of St. Paul. And now it seems that the concentration is in outstate Minnesota and not in the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul. So the pattern seems to have changed, and it would be good for us to understand where those children are. If we're going to serve them, we kind of need to know where they are, and that would be helpful to understand. So appreciate some additional information.
Certainly.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who's going to try to answer this, but as you may know, I'm a farmer by trade, so I was digging into the numbers about farm income on page 67 of the report. In the November forecast, looking at the year 2017 and 18 are really what I'm concerned about. In November, you were projecting some growth, but now in February, you're projecting a drop of 27.5% for 17 and a small drop in 18. Can you tell me what's changed? Should I be selling everything today?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, that is the, so what is, let me back up. Farm income was at very, very high levels due to high crop prices in 2013 were the big high years, lots of exports, and so we are coming off of a couple of years of negative growth or contraction in farm incomes from those high levels. This is partly due to the change in decrease in demand for our goods abroad, slowing down of China. It's also at the same time that was happening, so concurrently to that, we've had record high harvests for corn and soybeans. And so those things have dampened farm incomes going forward. So the forecast going forward is for this not to recover, but that commodity prices are going to remain low, and farm incomes are going to continue to bear that burden. The forecast that you see on page 67 is a proprietor income forecast that isn't precisely what we use for taxable farm income. And so the taxable farm income forecast is what I mentioned in my comments, which is that we had a double-digit decline in our taxable farm income in the forecast for 15, and then a smaller decline for 16, and then again for 17. And then it levels off.
Representative Torkelson.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm really curious about is what changed from November to February that caused that very dramatic change in the numbers.
Ms. Kolomakidis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. The chart on the table on page 67 is not showing forecast change. So that's showing the forecast for farm proprietor income. So it's not the change from forecast to forecast. From the November forecast to this forecast, we actually have very little change in farm income expectations.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
The November 2017 number was a 6% gain, and the November 2017 number in February is a 27.5% drop. It's not all on the same chart. I'm comparing November forecast numbers.
Oh, you have both of them.
I have both of them. You don't. But there's a dramatic change in the 2017 numbers, and I'm trying to discover if there's some reason for that.
Okay.
Ms. Kolomakidis.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative. This is, again, a BEA, a Bureau of Economic Analysis forecast, and it is not precisely what we use to inform our Minnesota taxable farm income forecast. So I can look into why this BEA forecast changed. So we have for 15, it's the 27.5 in 17 that you're looking at from from what we had was 6% growth. Mm-hmm. So I can look into why that forecast changed. It was likely a change in expectations for commodity prices. So the USDA's forecast for commodity prices is lower than it was, and that is largely due to slower global growth. In our forecast for taxable farm income, we did not change the expectation very much from November to February.
Representative Protocol.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If these numbers are anywhere close to real, we have a serious situation on our hands, and one that I hope the administration is considering.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Franz, you talked about, and so we've kind of heard the talking points now. Word of caution, and we heard that from the meeting last week, and some people are saying that we should only spend or do tax cuts, which, of course, many of us, as we look out for the people in Minnesota who actually pay the bill for this huge government we have here, are concerned about that's the discussion. And we heard that from you earlier. But then you went on to say we certainly should borrow a bunch of money for bonding, too. Realizing we already have $8.3 billion in debt, and our debt service is the fastest growing part of the general fund, $1.3 or more billion. It's probably more than that now since we already borrowed at $400 million last year. How do you square those two up?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the
issues that we look to in terms of budget balance. Obviously, we have to be mindful of what we spend in the general fund and reappropriate for ongoing operations. The other thing, though, that we look to is the relatively low cost for borrowing money at this time. In the last several times that we've sold our bonds, the rates have been, I think, under 3%, and we continue to have a very good success in making those kind of borrowings. So it's fairly common, certainly as I ran a business and other business people tend to use borrowing or bonding, in this case, to make capital improvements, make capital projects around the state. And so we view it, and the governor views it, as a way to invest in the state in a way that's fairly modest cost for the general fund. We're still well within our debt guidelines. Obviously, your concern is well noted, and we want to make sure that we stay within our guidelines, and this $1.4 billion bonding bill would stay well within all three of our guidelines going forward. So we square it because we think it's a good way to invest in the future at a fairly low budget cost today.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, Commissioner. And, of course, if we all thought it was investment and agreed with that term that now becomes another talking point and a buzzword, we know it really is spending, and we know that government does not create wealth. It's a private sector that creates that wealth. And so, you know, I see this change coming, and now government is getting back there and choking up and guarding that plate. And the people of Minnesota, Commissioner, again, are struggling as more and more money continues to get extracted from them in this projected over-collection. And when is it going to be the people's turn? Why is it that the focus seems to always be on the health of the government? It's always a government-centric discussion. Shouldn't we instead be looking at what's best for the people of Minnesota as they try to climb out of this recession?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we certainly believe it should be in the people's interest. You know, one of the things that we look to is history. And one of the things that we saw at the end of the 1990s and early 2000 was we were doing quite well, and we didn't see the downturn coming. And I'm not saying there's a downturn coming, don't get me wrong, but we didn't see some of the signals at that point. And I think one of the things that happened at that time was we gave a lot of the money back, we reduced the tax rates, and we ended up with a decade with 9 out of 11 years of deficits that followed from that decision. So the budget balance is an important component for the people, as well as, you know, you're concerned about the size of government. If you're going to have a government, we want to make sure that the budget is balanced and the revenue support the spending that the citizens want. And if the citizens want to reduce spending, then we can reduce revenue. But, you know, until we make that decision, we believe that having a structural balance that we have now, with a balance in 2016, 2017, and a balance in the next biennium, is an appropriate budget strategy to make sure that we make adjustments to spending in a careful, thoughtful way.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. You know, I just continue to struggle. I mean, we heard Ms. Kelly and Representative Liebling talking about the eligibility money, and you know, the audit said that we're spewing $1 million of the people's money out our tailpipe onto the road every day. And that follows a previous look at it by the legislative auditor the year before, and about 8 or 10 years of the legislative auditor citing the fact that these particular Medicaid dollars were not being properly accounted for in their eligibility by the department, or more recently by MNSHR. And we seem to be protecting this institutionally, this behavior, instead of admitting there's a problem. And so it seems to be about how much we can spend and then how much we can guard the plate to spend more, and let's spend more in the long term so that we put more debt on the people, even kids who haven't even been born yet. So I struggle with the duplicity of kind of this this approach from the administration, and hopefully we can work together this session to look out now that the government is fully funded, and that we do have certainly now the second another high level all-time high level of budget reserves in the history of this state, the highest reserves in the history of the state, on top of what used to be the highest budget reserves in the history of the state. I hope that we can look out for the people here, and I hope the administration will join many of us that are looking out for the interests of the people of this state instead of focusing exclusively on the interests of the health of the government.
Commissioner Friends, and I have a question from the bond houses, and when you're going through underwriting from the perspective of a bond capital investment bill, we oftentimes hear conversations, as you've heard around this table, with regard to the capacity for a bond bill based upon the gross revenue of the state. But is there also a balance in terms of the capacity to pay that debt, to manage that debt on an ongoing basis? We oftentimes think about the one-time investment, but there are tails on every a bond bill in terms of the repayment of that for the coupons. And I'm just wondering if there is some formula that you're using that would be privy to us on an ongoing basis to give us a gauge in terms of the debt capacity that we can manage and pay for without it being a drag on the GDP of the state. And I would appreciate your comments, as well as if Ms. Columbakidis has anything to say in terms of how that would reflect upon future forecasts leading into the GDP.
Now, Mr. Chair, well, one of the things that we issue every year is the state, the debt capacity guidelines. And in those guidelines, there are two of them that are of primary importance, and they both deal with total personal state income is the measure that we use, which is approaching about $300 billion in the next year or so. So the first one is 3.25%, and that is we try to limit the limit is the 3.25% of the total personal income in the state, and we do that on bonds that are actually sold. So part of the reason that we can issue more than $1.4 billion, we actually feel under that guideline we could issue $3.2 billion this year in debt and still be within the guideline, because it takes 2 to 3 to 4 5 years to actually sell those bonds, because sometimes the project's not ready for it in the first year, or maybe just part of the money goes out 1 year, part of the money goes out the next year. But in addition, remember, we're retiring debt every year. So we have this constant portfolio of bonds that we've sold over the years, and we're paying off every year, so that every year that goes down a little bit. If you add money on the bonding bill, you add a little bit more money to that. But the 3.25% limit actually would allow us to issue $3.5 billion in bonding this year. We're obviously not recommending that, just $1.4 billion. The other guideline is at 6%? 6% of that in terms of all issued debt. So that includes all debt that's not even sold yet. So that's a much bigger number, and we're way below that particular debt capacity guideline. So we've adopted these guidelines based on the rating agencies and their view of how, in terms of how much debt does the state have in relation to the total state personal income, as sort of a way to measure debt from one state to another state. And we've done that since 2009, I believe. So those guidelines are really important. We want to stay well underneath those guidelines, and that's why we recommend that when we do. But I can let Professor Columbakidis talk about the use of debt going forward and the drag that might or may not have.
Thank you. Professor?
Mr. Chair, can you just restate your question for me so I'm answering what you
In light of what Commissioner Franz said, I think part of the question has been answered, but I do think that it bears repeating that, you know, on an ongoing basis we have a debt management issue that will continue to grow, albeit maybe at a bit of a static rate as we roll off debt and add debt. But if we're looking at increasing debt, aren't we encumbering future bienniums to paying that debt off at potentially somewhat of a volatile nature? You've said in your report that we shouldn't rely upon the out years for the forecasts themselves, but yet we're making decisions now based upon a capital investment program that would obligate those bienniums out, you know, 2 or 3 bienniums, to pay down that debt.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just curious, from your position as the economic guru, it's rhetorical, but what is the risk in doing so to those outlying bienniums that we're talking about, where forecasts are nebulous at best?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so the cost of paying back the debt is on the spending side, and so it carries the risk of some other types of spending. Similarly, you have risk on the revenue side. So I haven't analyzed the volatility or the risk of the debt payments. It seems to me, just thinking about it, that we know how much money we're going to have to pay in debt, so we're pretty sure we can forecast what that is for a given bonding bill. So the risk would be more of the risk on the revenue side, that we're not the risk of not getting as much revenue as we have forecast, and so that places all of the expenditure side at risk, really. So my answer to that is pretty much what I said to Representative Carlson's question, which is all forecasts carry risk. The further out you go, the riskier it is. Looking at the 18-19 estimates, the planning estimates carries a particular amount of risk because even very small changes in some things like capital gains can affect that a great deal. So I'll leave it at that.
We have two people left. Hope that we can be brief in our questions. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I indicated I had a follow-up. It was to my earlier question, and maybe it's more in the form of a comment, but in response, it was pointed out that they monitor and build much of the budget off actual revenue. And my whole point was, though, that if the growth in the economy is slower than what we anticipate, that is going to have an impact at some point on the revenue that comes in, and that was the reason I was focusing on that. But that's more in a comment. But I do want to jump in a little bit on the bonding question. The commissioner pointed out that interest rates are low, and I would argue that the timing is good now. The chair is across there, and he knows that. Both in comments that I had with him personally over breakfast at least once, that I was a strong advocate for a bonding bill last year because interest rates were low. If you recall, Mr. Chairman, that was part of my argument when you and I were talking about it. And at that point, there was uncertainty whether we would have a bonding bill, but I thought the iron was hot, and interest rates are still low. So I would argue that this is a timely time, as the commissioner pointed out, to move ahead with capital investment. But I think what we have to keep in mind, and I guess I'm in part responding to the comments earlier, state of Minnesota, and I served a lot of years on capital investment. I don't happen to be on it this session, but I was on it for many, many years. Deferred maintenance is huge in the state of Minnesota. And if we're going to begin to address that, and we have the combination of low interest rates, I would argue that the time is to move forward. That's deferred maintenance, and then we have huge infrastructure needs as well. And then it does generate jobs. That was part of my concern last time, and I would suspect that that job, if the $1.4 billion bonding bill, would probably be somewhere between 15 and 20,000 jobs across the state of Minnesota. At least that would be close to the numbers that we've used in the past. So I guess I'm responding to the gentleman that left in part, but I think it's important that we take a good, solid look at a capital investment bill as we move forward. Now, a question that I have of Kalamakitas is the drop in wage growth. It goes from 4.7 to 3.8, and in your testimony, of course, you were pointing out that we have huge demands on labor. Huge demand for workers. And could you give us a little more insight as to what's driving that drop from the November forecast until this forecast in the projected wage growth? Because that also impacts, in my view, if we've got higher wages, that probably means more people are paying more into taxes one way or another. more purchasing on the sales tax or more on the income tax and so on?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, members of the committee, so a couple of things are happening here in the total wage growth forecast. One is that drop that you see in the 2016 forecast for the wage chart, that's pretty much a reflection of the drop you saw in the U.S. Forecast. So the biggest change in the U.S. forecast comes early in the forecast. That's what's happening to us here. We do use a lot of Minnesota-specific information in constructing our wage forecast, but what's bringing it down there is that general that decrease in general economic activity. Now, going forward, you can see we expect it to pick up. And one of the things we talked about in November that I didn't emphasize as much in my notes, but it is in the book, is that because of demographic change, labor force growth is slowing in Minnesota, which means that employment growth is also slowing in Minnesota because you count employment when you have a job and you have a person in that job. And so as labor force growth slows, employment can only grow as fast as we are adding workers. But going forward, we have this moderate growth in total wage and salary income, the 4.7, 4.6, 4.4 you see in that chart. What we think going forward is that more of that growth is going to be because average wages and salaries are going up. So that's the demand for workers. If you have high demand for workers, the price per worker should go up. And that's what we're forecasting going forward, that more of the growth in wage and salaries going forward is because of average wages and salaries going up, because the growth of the number of people working is going to slow down.
Okay, you want to adjourn, so I'll stop.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to respond a little bit to what Representative Drazkowski said, and unfortunately he left. There was a lot of controversy around the auditor's report that he was discussing, and I just want to make that very clear. They made some assumptions. First of all, they looked at a group of people at a time when DHS had not been able to get to re-verify this particular group of people. They looked at that group of people and said, oh my goodness, some of them don't belong in the programs. Well, then DHS looked at them also and said, gee, some of them don't belong. It wasn't something DHS had missed. They simply hadn't gotten to them yet. There are all kinds of other issues there, and why a lot of us are really disputing the results of that audit. And my point in bringing it up was just that if that audit was so solid and that projection of wasted money was so solid, one would have expected it to show up here in the forecast, unless I'm misunderstanding the forecast completely. And it isn't there. So I think that far from what Representative Drazkowski was saying, that should give us a little comfort that those estimates were off. Nobody is arguing that our system is perfect or that it doesn't need improvement. But I believe, and I think a lot of us who looked closely at that report believe, that the auditor's methodology was seriously flawed and that the report the conclusions were not really held up well by the methodology that was used. So I just wanted to make that comment because, he seemed to be taking that data and really running with it. So thank you for letting me do that.
And I'm sure that those comments will be heard in Health and Human Services,
yes,
Finance,
indeed,
in the coming session.
Chair.
Representative Torkelson, you have the final word.
Sorry, but I have something I would like to give. It won't take long. I'll get it out.
Representative Torkelson.
This is in relation to Guideline 2 that we utilize for the bonds. We were surprised, frankly, that the size of that number, but we're unable to compare it to past years because an official guideline has not been issued, even though it's been statutorily required. Can you help me?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure about the official guideline that has not
the
been
$3.2 billion now, Guideline 2. You've actually officially put it in your report. In the past, it hasn't been there.
Oh.
How can I compare to the past when the past is missing?
Commissioner Brown.
Mr. Chair, we'll get that information for you. I'm sorry, yeah.
I would appreciate that very much.
Yeah.
Thank you for your testimony. I think we've had a robust conversation. That being said, committee is adjourned.